Plato. In that famous trio of the greatest ancient Greek philosophers, he's the man in the middle, Plato. A student of Socrates and a teacher to Aristotle, Plato's work touched on virtually every problem and question that has occupied philosophers ever since. Plato was born in Athens in either 427 or 428 BC, about 42 years after Socrates. It was the zenith of classical Greece, marked by great achievements in art, theater, architecture, science, poetry, government, music, and, of course, philosophy. Plato's contemporaries included the great dramatists Euripides and Sophocles, Phidias the sculptor, Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, the orator Demosthenes, Herodotus, the father of history, and Democritus, founder of the atomic theory. But as Plato was growing up, Athens was starting its decline. His life spanned the demise of the glories of Greece and the rise of Macedonia under Alexander the Great. Plato was born into one of the oldest and most distinguished families in Athens. His mother, Perictione, was related to the great Athenian lawmaker Solon. Plato's father, Ariston, was related to the last king of Athens and claimed to be a direct descendant of the god Poseidon. He died when Plato was still a child, and his mother remarried her uncle, Pyrilampes. He was a colleague of Pericles, the leader of the Athenian Empire, a champion of democracy, and a man devoted to art and beauty. It was under Pericles' leadership that Athens achieved its golden age. From early on, it seemed Plato was destined for a life as an aristocrat and a politician. As a boy, Plato probably received the same education most boys of the time received. He himself described it in some of his writings. "When the boy has learned his letters and is beginning to understand what is written, as before he understood only what was spoken, they put into his hands the works of great poets, which he reads sitting on a bench at school. In these are contained many admonitions and many tales and praises of ancient famous men, which he is required to learn by heart, in order that he may imitate them and desire to become them." There were no children's books in Athens. All boys started their reading with adult classics. They recited passages over and over, or listened to their teachers recite them, until some boys had memorized Homer's Iliad and Odyssey beginning to end. The recitations weren't boring, however. They were always done with much drama and theatrical flair. Besides his exposure to politics, Plato was said as a child to show talent in poetry. Although he didn't pursue it as either a vocation or avocation, his philosophical writings are often beautifully poetic and grand in style. In 404 BC, when Plato was 24, a group of wealthy men temporarily established themselves as dictators of Athens. And since two of them were relatives of Plato, he was invited to join them. He refused, because he was appalled by their cruelty and immorality. The next year, when the dictatorship was overthrown and Athens returned to democracy, Plato once again became politically active. But as the Athenian government deteriorated and became more known for its excesses and its tyranny than its earlier democratic glory, Plato began to rethink his future. Then, in the year 399 BC, there was an event that caused him to finally renounce politics completely and to find a new life's purpose. Early in his life, probably in childhood, Plato had become acquainted with the famous Athenian philosopher Socrates, who was a friend of some of Plato's relatives. Like many young men of his time, he was irresistibly drawn to Socrates' deep wisdom and nobility of character. It was said that when the venerable Socrates entered the gymnasium, the young men immediately ceased their games and rushed to his side to hear him speak. When Plato was 27, Socrates was condemned to death on the absurd charge of corrupting the young and not believing in the city's gods. He was ordered to die by drinking a cup of poisoned hemlock, which he obediently did, refusing opportunities to escape and facing his death with much grace and serenity. The trial and the death of Socrates were shocking to Plato and changed his life forever. The relationship between these two great philosophers is one we know almost exclusively from the writings of Plato himself. Socrates left no writings at all. It doesn't seem that Plato belonged to the inner circle of Socrates' disciples. He doesn't refer to him as the master, but rather as an older friend, whose character he deeply respected. He also wasn't present at Socrates' death, as many of the disciples were. His account of that day was written from stories these witnesses told him later. But whatever their exact relationship, there's no doubt Socrates had a profound effect on Plato, and that it was Socrates' death that committed him to philosophy. He also owes to Socrates his rational method of thought, and the concern for ethics that developed in his own philosophical writings. With the execution of his friend and teacher Socrates, Plato decided there was no place for men of conscience in politics. Later, he would decide the only hope for politics was to found a school and create within it a new kind of political character, one based on the love of wisdom, the true meaning of the word philosophy. But first, after the death of Socrates, Plato retired from public life and began his years of travel. After the execution, he fled with other disciples to Megara until things quieted down. After that, he spent several years traveling in Greece, Egypt, Italy, and Sicily. In Sicily, he was disgusted by the gross sensuality of life, but he made a good friend in a man named Dion, brother-in-law of Dionysus I, a tyrant who ruled the city of Syracuse. When he was about 41 in the year 387 BC, Plato founded a school in Athens that was to become one of the most famous in world history, and the one often credited with being the first university. It was called the Academy. The Academy was designed as an institution where students could diligently pursue scientific and philosophical knowledge towards the goal of restoring good government to the Greek cities. One of Plato's most famous comments, and one Ralph Waldo Emerson liked to quote, was, "The punishment which the wise suffer who refuse to take part in the government is to live under the government of worse men." His way of taking part was to educate. Many of his students later entered politics, and many others became government advisors, or what we'd call today consultants. The ultimate goal of the Academy, however, was to turn the thoughts of the students and humankind in general to the eternal and unchanging truths that existed behind the material world, or to shift them, as Plato put it, from becoming to being. The Academy stood in a beautiful grove of trees that, according to legend, was once owned by a Greek hero named Academus, thus the name of the school. The setting was carefully chosen by Plato, who had bemoaned the loss of green meadows, woods, and springs in the Athenian landscape, which had given way to limestone buildings. The school was equipped with a library and scientific equipment, and it offered both lectures and seminars. The pupils united themselves in what they called a museum, a society dedicated to the patrons of letters and music, which were called the Muses. Students would stay at the Academy for 20 years, even for life, taking part in the common studies, religious exercises, and meals. They paid no fees, although they may have made contributions. The larger expenses were borne by philanthropists. The subjects taught at the Academy included astronomy, biological sciences, sound or harmonics, political science, and mathematics, including geometry. Every subject was chosen on the basis of its potential to lead students to higher thought, of issues that transcended mundane, worldly life. Of astronomy, Plato said, "It is clear to everyone that astronomy, at all events, compels the soul to look upwards and draws it from the things of this world to the other." Each student spent 10 years studying these basic disciplines, and then may have chosen to stay longer. Plato himself lectured at the school and helped design its curriculum, but he never wrote a textbook. It's said that he always lectured without prepared notes. He also gave lectures in public occasionally. One that seems to have been very well received was a lecture entitled On the Good, even though most people came expecting to hear how they could find happiness and were surprised to hear instead a lecture on mathematics. The Academy was the most influential school of the ancient world and lasted for nearly 900 years, longer than any such school before or since. Plato taught there until his death, a period of about 40 years. Under his guidance, the Academy became the recognized authority in both mathematics and law. In the 4th century BC, all the most important mathematical work was done by friends and students of Plato, including Theaetetus, creator of solid geometry, and Archytas, the inventor of mechanical science. Plato considered the abstract work in pure mathematics to be one of the highest forms of thought of which the human mind was capable. Because of that, he had inscribed over the entrance to the Academy, "Let no one ignorant of mathematics enter here." He once said, "No branch of education is considered so valuable a preparation for household management and politics, and all arts and crafts, sciences and professions, as arithmetic. Best of all, by some divine art, it arouses the dull and sleepy brain and makes it studious, mindful, and sharp." There's a story that one student at the academy who struggled painfully to understand abstract mathematics finally asked Plato, "What practical ends do these theories serve?" Plato turned to his servant and said, "Give this man a coin that he may feel he has gained something from my teachings, and then expel him." Mathematics was not the entire focus of the academy, however. There were achievements in other areas, too. Plato's nephew wrote volumes on natural history. Others completed biological studies. And academy students traveled throughout the empire to advise rulers on laws and governorship. When Alexander the Great asked for advice on kingship, the man who arrived and who did the most to incite him to war on the barbarians was an associate of Plato's named Delios of Ephesus. Plato's most able and famous student was Aristotle, who stayed at the academy 20 years and left only at Plato's death. He later founded a school of his own called the Lyceum. While the academy focused on mathematics, the Lyceum focused more on science, especially biology. There was a rivalry between the two schools, and Aristotle sometimes criticized Plato's ideas, but he always maintained a profound respect and admiration for his former teacher, once commenting that he was a man whom it is blasphemy in the base even to praise, meaning he was so noble that inferior men shouldn't even attempt to speak of him. Little is known of Plato's exact personality or character, although there's ample evidence of his integrity, his creative thought, and his self-mastery. He didn't live the life of poverty and asceticism his friend Socrates had, and instead kept a comfortable home with a garden in Athens, from which he commuted about a mile to the academy. Diogenes visited Plato at home once and was disgusted to find rich and exquisite carpets on the floor. Diogenes belonged to the philosophical school of Cynicism and believed humans should reject all property and material goods and reduce their needs to the barest minimum. To show his contempt for Plato's carpets, he stamped and wiped his feet on them, commenting, "Thus do I trample upon the pride of Plato." "And with greater pride," replied Plato calmly. Later, Plato described Diogenes as a Socrates gone mad. When Plato was 61, Dionysus I died, and Plato's friend Dion asked him to come to Syracuse in southern Italy to be the tutor for the new king, Dionysus II. It was an opportunity that must have intrigued Plato, the chance to influence and train an enlightened ruler. But he admitted he felt pessimistic about his chances for success. The plan was to train the young heir in science and philosophy, and to encourage him to establish a constitution. Dionysus became very attached to Plato and enjoyed his teachings, but problems developed in other areas. The plan failed when Dionysus became jealous of Dion, claimed he'd plotted against him, and had him banished. Out of loyalty to Dion, Plato demanded that he be returned from exile. This only made Dionysus more jealous. He not only refused to allow Dion to return, but he refused to allow Plato to leave. Eventually, he relented, and Plato returned to the academy, only more convinced of the ignorance that plagued politics. Dionysus recalled Plato to Syracuse 6 years later, promising that if he came, he would also allow Dion to return. But once he had Plato there, he broke his promise, and in fact confiscated all of Dion's property. Plato had to use the influence of a neighboring ruler to get out of Syracuse and return to Athens. He never left again. When he returned to the academy, Plato took up his teaching and writing again. His writings are considered to be among the most eloquent and readable in all of philosophy, a field which now is so often marked by work that is turgid and tedious. Plato, in many ways the original philosopher, wrote with flair and drama. His descriptions of Socrates' trial and death, even besides their philosophical merit, are some of the most compelling works in literature. Plato lived a long life and continued to write and teach right up until his final years. He said, "He who is of a calm and happy nature will hardly feel the pressure of age, But to him who is of an opposite disposition, youth and age are equally a burden. Plato died in either the year 348 or 347 BC at the age of about 80, and his nephew took over leadership of the academy. It survived until the year 529 AD, when all schools of philosophy were closed by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian I, whose Christian principles didn't sit well with the classical traditions. He considered Plato and other Greek philosophers to be pagans. An emperor can close schools, but he cannot, however, close minds. Plato's ideas had great influence on Christianity during the Middle Ages, partly through the writings of St. Augustine. During the 1200s, the ideas of Plato's student Aristotle took on greater influence than his teachers. But there was a revival of Platonism during the Renaissance when the Medicis, famous patrons of the arts, established a Platonic academy in Florence as a center for the study of his ideas. Most of Plato's ideas were presented in the form of dramatic dialogues, conversations between two or more people. All of his words come from the mouths of characters who may or may not be based on real people. Socrates is usually the center character in these conversations. Plato is still recognized as a master of the dialogue form and one of the greatest prose writers in the Greek language. His dialogues are really dramas in which he presents, criticizes, and shows the conflicts of philosophical ideas. The characters argue opposing sides of an issue. There are 36 of Plato's works that survive through the ages, and historians believe this may be the total of what he wrote. 35 are dialogues, and the other is a group of letters, many of which are thought to be forgeries. Generally, Plato's writings are divided into two groups: the early works, which were heavily influenced by Socrates, and the later works, which were uniquely his own. Within these two larger groups are three distinct periods. His earliest existing works are his Socratic dialogues, so named because they record the life and ideas of his great teacher. In most of these works, Socrates questions people who claim to know or understand an idea about which Socrates claims to be ignorant. But what happens in the end, of course, is that the other people reveal their ignorance. Socrates never provides the answers to the questions. He simply shows that the answers of the others are inadequate. Three of these early works describe Socrates' behavior before, during, and after his trial. The Apology was written in defense of Socrates and is supposedly the speech Socrates made at his trial. The best known of these early works is the moving account Plato has left us of Socrates' death. One work, called Phaedon, is the specific account of what Socrates said on his last day of life. If not for Plato, Socrates would have had no recognizable effect on history. Almost all that the world knows of him came through his student. In the work of Plato's middle period, which was begun after he founded the academy, he tried to show the relationship between the soul, the state, and the universe. The most famous of these is The Republic, long believed to be Plato's greatest work. In The Republic, Plato sets up an ideal state or community ruled by philosophers who understand the harmony of all parts of the universe. In describing it, he said, "It will be, in all likelihood, an agreeable, lawless, party-colored commonwealth, dealing with all alike on a footing of equality, whether they be really equal or not." Plato describes the education the rulers of his republic should receive and divides the state into three parts or classes. 1, the philosopher kings who govern the society. 2, the guardians who keep order and defend the society. And 3, the ordinary citizens who provide the society's material needs. Each of those citizens performs the task for which they're best suited. He wrote, "All things will be produced in superior quantity and quality, and with greater ease, when each man works at a single occupation, in accordance with his natural gifts, and at the right moment, without meddling in anything else." Plato had no slavery in his republic, an extraordinary decision for the times when most upper-class Greek citizens owned slaves, and no one had ever questioned it, much less openly opposed it. Plato didn't openly oppose it either, but he did once say, "A slave is an embarrassing possession." The most important part of Plato's ideal government is education. Those who received the special education for ruling would primarily be the children of the rulers, but some of these would be rejected if they were inferior, and some of the common people who were superior would also be included. There would be no family life or private property among the rulers. They would live communally as a united and selfless whole. Their houses would be small and their food plain. Women and men were completely equal. Children would be taken at birth to be communally raised, never knowing who their parents were. Those born deformed would be done away with. This way, he felt, private sentiment would decline and public spirit would grow stronger. The education of Plato's would-be rulers would be intense, including a rigorous program of gymnastics that was almost military. Gymnastics and music to Plato were two paths toward enlightenment. However, the music had to be carefully selected. Children in the Republic would never come in contact with music or poetry that is corrupting or degrading. Books were to be screened as well. Even Homer's classics were to be banned because they portrayed the gods as jealous and quarrelsome as mortals. While young, the trainees would be sheltered from evil. When older, they were to meet both fears and temptations. If they resisted them, they could proceed. Those who passed all tests by the age of 20 would be assured some role in the ruling class for life, but that exact role would depend on the success of their studies in the following 15 years. Plato felt the people in the highest offices especially needed advanced mathematics. Mathematics, he felt, was a bridge from the sensible to the unintelligible world. Those who persevered the whole way through would become the governors of this ideal city. They would then be at least 50 years old. As governors who were wiser than the common masses, Plato gave them the right to lie if it served the greatest good. He wrote, "To the rulers of the state, then, if to any, it belongs of right to use falsehood, to deceive either enemies or their own citizens for the good of the state, and no one else may meddle with this privilege." Plato's concept of the ideal government has been a source of controversy, debate, and analysis among philosophers and politicians for over 2,000 years. It's led to just the kind of self-examination and questioning that he intended many of his writings to provoke. Much of Plato's work is based on the same style of questioning that Socrates was famous for, such as, what is temperance? What is courage? Or what is holiness? Many think that the Republic was originally a dialogue devoted to the question, what is justice? On the surface, most of Plato's dialogues seem to end in ignorance, with no answer or solution reached. But in reality, each is structured so that a complex and subtle understanding emerges as the dialogue progresses. In all of Plato's later dialogues, completed after he returned from Syracuse, where he tried to make a philosopher king out of Dionysus II, Socrates has disappeared into the background. These works contain dialogues on law, mathematics, natural science, and more technical problems of philosophy. His last and longest work, The Laws, is an attempt to write a model constitution for an ideal city. Above all else, Plato is most associated with his belief in the reality of ideas. Ideas, or forms, were to him unchanging archetypes or models of everything in the material world. For instance, the idea of good was represented in the physical world by the sun, which brings with it illumination. Plato was interested in how we can apply one word or concept to a variety of objects. For instance, the word chair is used for all the different objects that are chairs. His answer was that different things could be called by the same name because they all shared something in common. This common shared characteristic was the thing's form or idea. There are forms of everything in the world: man and woman, stone, colors, shapes, beauty, justice. And the highest, most important form of all is what he called the form of the good. He wrote, "In the world of knowledge, the essential form of good is the limit of our inquiries and can barely be perceived. But when perceived, we cannot help concluding that it is in every case the source of all that is bright and beautiful, in the visible world giving birth to light and its master, and in the intellectual world dispensing immediately and with full authority truth and reason, and that whosoever would act wisely, either in private or in public, must set this form of good before his eyes. These ideas or forms he held to be universal and absolute, while the thing itself, the chair, might change. Its form or idea did not. Furthermore, the object was never as perfect as the idea itself. While the world is changing and imperfect, the idea is always perfect and unchanging. It does not exist in space or time, and it has greater reality than the thing itself. Thus, true knowledge is the knowledge of forms. This theory of forms and ideas was the foundation for all of Plato's philosophy. In the Republic, the most advanced students, who would be trained as the highest rulers, were to be taught the study of forms, culminating in the study of the form of good. His theory was that they would have such passion for the form by then, they would have no interest in ruling, something he saw as a distinct advantage. They would be ruling not out of desire for power or from pride, but from responsibility. To Plato, ultimate virtue was reached when the human soul was in harmony with the universe of ideas. Only such harmony would bring order and intelligence to a world that's in constant flux. The philosopher himself is in love with these forms, that is, in love with the world as it truly is, not as it appears. The power of reason also plays a key role in Plato's work. Only through reason, he felt, could people come to understand the order that governs the changing world of appearance. Ideas and forms could be understood not with the senses, but with the intellect. And only with that understanding could people achieve lasting happiness at both the personal and political level. Virtue to Plato was understanding, and the good life, therefore, had to be grounded in knowledge. Plato also contributed much to the field of ethics. His belief was that all people desired happiness, but few know which actions will bring happiness. In his view, it was the life of virtue that guaranteed happiness. It was also his view that people seldom lived a life of virtue only because they were unaware of its link to happiness, a view that differs from that of most Christian philosophers who argue that people know what is morally right but are unwilling to do it. To Plato, they were simply ignorant. To Plato, it was far worse to commit an injustice than to suffer one, because immoral behavior is the symptom of a diseased soul. He also felt it was worse for a person who commits an injustice to go unpunished than to be punished, because punishment is an initial step towards learning and healing. Plato believed that though the body dies, the soul continues to live forever. It migrates to what he calls the realm of pure forms, where it spends some time contemplating these forms. Then it's reincarnated into a new body and returns to the world. This happens over and over again, but through it all, the reincarnated soul has a dim, subconscious memory of the realm of perfect forms, and so it continually longs for it. He also argued that people fall in love because they recognize in the beauty of their beloved the ideal form of beauty that they remember and are seeking. But this romantic or passionate love is only a step on the way to higher love. In writing of love, Plato said, "In particular, I may mention Sophocles, the poet, who was once asked in my presence, 'How do you feel about love, Sophocles? Are you still capable of it?' To which he replied, 'Hush, if you please. To my great delight, I have escaped from it, and feel as if I had escaped from a frantic and savage master.' I thought then, as I do now, that he spoke wisely." The idea that learning is really recollection is one of Plato's most important and famous concepts. To him, it meant that all people could be taught to attain the truth, since all people already hold that truth in their memories. Plato was an idealist who taught that goodness was worth being sought for its own sake, rather than for any material or ego reward, and that the soul is not nourished by earthly things, but by beauty, wisdom, truth, and love. In all his teachings, he emphasized that the greatest, truest, and eternal things in life are not the things that can be seen. The beginning of philosophy, he said, was puzzlement, the need to know, to understand, to attain clarity and truth. In two ways, Plato held a pivotal role in the history of philosophy. He represented the culmination of what's called pre-Socratic philosophy. That is, he integrated all the great ideas of the age that preceded him, which included such majestic thinkers as Pythagoras. While doing that, he also prepared the way for a new age, one that started with Aristotle and continues to the present. In this way, he was a bridge. He was also the bridge between two great thinkers of his own age, Socrates and Aristotle. He learned from the former and taught to the latter, thereby becoming the link in this incomparable trio. Plato's teachings have been among the most influential in the history of civilization, and his writings are considered some of the finest in world literature. His work established all the important problems and concepts of Western philosophy, psychology, logic, and politics. It's been said that any philosopher who thinks he has something new to say had better first read the ancient Greeks, and particularly Plato. It was Plato, as his writings and ideas spread throughout Europe, who brought the word philosophy into common use. Today, the best answer to the question, "What is a philosopher?" is still to say, Plato.
This is the end of the session.